Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, traveler, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Sarah.
What's on your mind?
How are you doing?
I'm okay. What's on your mind today?
I've found myself asking everyone, stranger, friend, family member, how they're doing today, because it's tough. It feels like just when we start to poke our heads up and look around, something comes and whacks us back down. And I was concerned because I received an email from a former client this morning, and it was the first time I'd heard from them in a long time, and it was a very short note that said, "The fires were the last straw. I can't keep doing this." And I know that they're not the only ones that are feeling like that. And I was so relieved that they took the time to email and to reach out and that I could respond and connect them to some resources and offer some support. But I don't think that that is an uncommon sentiment right now. I don't think that we talk enough about what it feels like to get to the last straw place, or to the I can't take it anymore place, or the I'm done trying place. We don't talk about it because I think it's really terrifying. In some ways, I think it's terrifying because many of us have had those feelings ourselves. And when someone says to us, I can't take it anymore, it can trigger our own feelings of doubt. Well, I don't know if I can take it anymore, or I don't know if I'm okay. And so it's a scary thing to talk about, and it's a scary thing to address because we don't want to activate those feelings inside of us that might be feeling like we're at the end of our rope or that we don't have hope. And at the same time, when someone tells us they're feeling desperate or hopeless or lonely, and we're not quite sure how to respond, we hesitate to have those conversations. Because what if the person says they can't go on anymore and I say something that makes it worse? What if they tell me that they're hopeless and I try to be supportive and yet they try to take their life anyway? Am I responsible? And we don't talk about how to talk about things that are painful. And right now, a lot of conversations are about things that are painful. And right before I went on the air today, I received a text from my best friend. And we don't text every day normally. We have our check-ins, we have long phone calls. But today of all days, she sent me a text out of the blue and just said, "Hey, I had a sense you needed this. Not sure why. Here's your text." And that little check-in helped me get on the air today and feel ready to go. Because even though I do this for a living, I still need to check in. I still need to remember to tell people that I love when I'm struggling. Because when you're a clinician and a professor and a mom and a grandmother, you're in a position where a lot of people are looking to you so that they'll be okay. But I still have to remember to look around to make sure that I'm supporting myself when times when I'm not feeling okay. So that's a lot of dancing around the topic for this week because it's Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month, the month of September. And every September for the 11 years I've been doing this program, we take some time in September to talk about suicide prevention and awareness. And it's something that's incredibly close to my heart, not just as a clinician and because I've worked with people who have struggled, but when I was 19 years old, my uncle took his life. And that was shocking and unexpected. And no one in the family really said what it was for a really long time. And I was 19, I wasn't a child, but no one said how my uncle died for a really long time, except for whispers from aunts or cousins who guessed what might have really happened. But we said it was a heart attack. And right there, the possibilities of healing in my family got stuck. Because when you can't talk about what really happened, then everybody's left to grieve alone or to wonder or to be concerned or to not know what to do with their own feelings. Because when suicide happens in a family, it opens a door for other members of the family that might not have been there before. When someone takes their own life, members who are close to them might be thinking, well, I've thought of that too, and now it becomes more of a possibility. 3 years ago, my cousin took her own life. another unexpected, shocking experience. We're the same age. We'd grown up together. We'd spent our whole lives in contact. And yet she had drifted away at some point and went down another path and felt that her only option was taking her own life. So suicide prevention awareness is really close to my heart. It's something important to talk about, because what I also know is true, that every time we talk about something that's painful, someone's life improves. Someone feels less alone. Someone feels less lonely. Someone feels like they're not the only person who has these thoughts. And quite often, it's just one person sending you a text saying, hey, you're on my mind today, that can stop someone from going down a path of self-destruction. That it doesn't take magic words or just the right response or 8 years of clinical training to be able to help someone when they're feeling suicidal. It just takes the courage to say, are you all right? Are you struggling? Have you thought of hurting yourself? And just those questions can bring someone back and help them on the road to recovery. So this week I've invited Alicia Hendry, the suicide prevention coordinator for the County of San Luis Obispo, to be my guest to talk about her experiences doing this work, what brought her into this work, and how we can participate in the goals of suicide prevention of hope, resilience, and recovery for 2020. And with all that's happening, it is the time for some hope and developing resilience and recovery. So I'm looking forward to the conversation, and we will have the phone lines open, not able to take calls live, but we can take your questions and comments. So if you're feeling like you want to call in, our number is 805-549-8855. If you need to reach out and make a comment, or if you would like resources and phone numbers to get some help, we have them for you today. So you can call 805-549-8855 and someone will answer the phone, a live person to talk to you and take your question or comment. And if you would like to get some immediate help, please utilize the suicide prevention text line, which is 741-741. You text 741-741 and put in the message box, I need help, or I'm not okay, and someone will text you back almost immediately. And if you'd like to make a phone call to get help, you can use the national hotline number of 1-800-273-8255, 1-800-273-TALK. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you can participate also by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. I'm happy to send resources to you to provide you with information. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can follow us on Instagram, leave messages, find out what we're doing. And you can also listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. I am here with Alicia Hendry. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back to have our conversation.
I'm blue. What I won't be blue always. Cause the sun's gonna shine in my back door someday. Trouble in mind, that's true. I've almost lost my mind.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And my guest, Alicia Hendry, is the Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the County of San Luis Obispo. Alicia, thank you so much for Zooming in with me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Elizabeth. I appreciate it.
So I'm surprised we've never met or talked before. Is your position a new one, or has it been part of the county for a long time?
It is new-ish. I started July 2018, and I'm the first one to work this position, so relatively new.
So can you tell me what it is, like, what is your job description? What is your department's goal?
Absolutely. So I'll start by letting you know the funding source. This program, the Suicide Prevention Coordinator Program, is funded by the Mental Health Services Act, so Prop 63, voter approved in 2004 and implemented in 2005. And this is one of kind of the auxiliary positions. Not every county necessarily needs a suicide prevention coordinator, but we really identified our local stakeholders here in the last couple of years, identified the need for this position in the county. And so between Transitions Mental Health Association and County Behavioral Health, they really advocated for the funding for this position. And part of what my job description does is I'm currently working on a strategic plan for suicide prevention for our county that will involve a lot of our partners. I also do a lot of different presentations, educational training. I chair or co-chair now the Suicide Prevention Council of San Luis Obispo County, and we do a lot of great work there. I also host an annual forum, which was actually last week. We welcomed an amazing speaker that has a photo exhibit of suicide attempt survivors. So I help with community engagement. We do a lot of outreach within our department. And we're also doing right now a community survey that's just, we're just trying to figure out kind of what the knowledge of suicide is in our community, the desire to learn more about it. So it's a lot of behind the scenes work. I'm not a clinician. I don't see clients, but I do have a lot of really meaningful conversations with people and do a lot of trainings to help folks navigate those conversations as well.
So is there something particular about the county of San Luis Obispo, and I would imagine Santa Barbara and Monterey, that would warrant having a coordinator position? Do we have a higher than average number of suicides? What brought that about? That decision?
We do. So the state average for the rate, so the rate per 100,000 people is about 10.4 right now, 10.4 deaths per 100,000 people. In our county, it's about 17. So our rate is higher than the national average, not higher than the state average. I know. It's really sad. I was born and raised in San Luis Obispo. I call this place home, and I really feel it when I know that my community is in pain.
I want to talk about why that is in the happiest place on earth,
right?
That we would have those rates.
Right.
But before we jump to that, why are you doing this work?
I have my own personal experience with suicide with an attempt when I was younger, and I also lost a dear friend to suicide, and I just had so many questions and so much uncertainty. Why didn't I learn about this in high school? Why weren't we talking about mental health at a younger age in health class? Abraham Lincoln experienced depression. Why isn't that incorporated in history classes? You know, I had so many questions, and I had not a very typical journey compared to a lot of my peers post high school. And so I went back to school in my later 20s with the goal of wanting to form new meaning around mental health. I feel honestly that this job found me. I didn't imagine working in suicide prevention specifically, but once I saw this job position, and now that I've been working this for 2 years, I know I'm meant to do it. I know that I have purpose. It's been really impactful. And I don't know if I've ever met anyone else in suicide prevention specifically, that type of work that hasn't been affected by suicide. So, yeah.
So what was your experience when you was younger? Was your attempt when you're in high school? Was an adolescent? Or was
It was post high school. So I stopped going to college, and there are a lot of complications with my mental health, with my circumstance, that I got to a point where I felt so trapped, and that that was it. Like, I couldn't face my family. I couldn't face my friends. I was embarrassed. I held shame. And the reason why I want to talk about this is because it can happen to anyone. And I think talking about it, hopefully if you're out there listening or you know someone that's struggling, there's hope, and and hard times happen, but it's the community that really pulls you back together. It's your family and your loved ones. And sometimes that's your chosen family, right? It's not the family you're born into, but it's my mission to help destigmatize these issues so that we can talk about them.
And it's, you said, you know, that that things start to compound,
yes.
You know, that we, it sneaks up on you where all of a sudden you find that there's no out, that you're going along and you think you're doing well in life and you make a few decisions and you bounce back from those decisions.
Right.
But it, we talk, you know, the stress pileup, right? That
yeah.
All of a sudden when you were able to catch your breath, and I talked about at the top of the show, that every time we pop up for air, if you get hit with another wave and go right. under, it becomes more difficult.
Yeah, you're exhausted. And bear with me through this analogy right now, but in my mind, I think it paints a picture. But if you've ever played the game Jenga before, so you have that tower of wooden blocks. You pull out one from the bottom, you put it on the top. You pull out one from the side, you put it on the top. And it's still standing, right? Even though there's holes in that tower, it's still standing until one day you pull that final block out and the tower tips over. So oftentimes we will look at a situation, someone who dies by suicide or who just experienced an attempt, and we're like, oh, well, they were being bullied at school, or they just lost their job and so they tried to kill themselves. And while that may be kind of that event, that adverse event that happens that tips them over, oftentimes there's not that solid foundation. There's not the coping skills. You don't have a supportive network around you. Maybe you're experiencing food insecurity or housing insecurity. And like you said, the waves come and you just, it builds up.
And I think for women in particular, and I think I'm correct, you can feel free to correct me. It never hurts my feelings.
Okay.
But from what I understand, women have higher rates of suicidal ideation, although men have higher rates of attempts or completion. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we know it's always hard to gather attempt and ideation data because that's self-reported. But we do know from that from people self-reporting that women attempt about 3 times more frequently than men do. And I'm speaking on biological sex right now, mm-hmm. just to clarify. And then we know that men die at a rate about 3 times more frequently than women do. And we think that's, the data suggests it's because of the method in which people choose to use. And so we know that firearms are more lethal than other forms of death.
And I'm glad you brought up with the biological sex, because I also understand that the suicide rates and ideation of the LGBTQ community, especially teenagers, is much higher than any of the other areas except for middle-aged men.
Yeah. So we know we did a needs assessment here. Cal Poly and Tima worked on that, and the county as well. But through that needs assessment, we know that the youth, especially trans youth, so LGBTQ plus identifying youth, and then trans specifically youth and gender nonconforming, have reported like 59%, I believe. So around 69% had seriously considered suicide in the past year. It breaks my heart to think that people are hurting that bad, especially at such a young age when you have the potential for a fulfilling life ahead of you. And so I'll say this now and I'll say it again, but using people's pronouns that they ask you to use is a life-saving measure. And so, you know, the language we use around suicide, it's the same, the language we use around our identities, giving someone that dignity to use their pronouns can save their life.
All right. So Alicia, I'm going to ask you, when you meet someone,
yes,
and this, and I'm picturing my parents and a lot of my listeners, they know who this is new to them.
Of course, yeah.
How do you address that then? How do you make that a natural part of the conversation so that people feel seen and identified correctly?
Well, first, you know, it's when people identify themselves. So there's a lot of the times in a meeting, for example, they'll say, my name is Alicia Hendry. I use she, her pronouns. And that's just letting people know how to identify me. Oftentimes you can also, people will identify as they or them, him or hers. And I hear it a lot where people are like, well, it doesn't make sense to me grammatically. And my response to them is we need to just try a little harder. But I understand too, you know, when you're around people that have never had this type of exposure before, meeting them where they're at, like, okay, well, just, you know, this is a way that people identify themselves. And, you know, things are changing, times are changing. And if, you know, you have an issue doing it, then you just need to address that within yourself and honor that that is how that person wants to be identified. I work a lot with Michelle Call over at GALA, the Pride and Diversity Center, and they do, Michelle and her crew there do a lot of trainings. And so if you ever want to have a community training or one for your agency, for example, it's very educational and they go into a lot of the history of the LGBTQ plus rights movement. And it just gives you a little bit more information and background and perspective.
69% is unacceptable for any population to be feeling such desperation and hopelessness. And when you hear that statistic, then you have to understand that someone you pass today on the street is hurting in a profound way.
Yeah.
And it goes back to what I said at the beginning of the show. I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of weeks saying, hello, how are you doing, to strangers that I see at the grocery store,
or
to make sure that we're seeing people, just seeing them and letting them know that we're here.
Yeah. And I think I crave that attention and connection with people. And I think that's something that's been missing even prior to the pandemic. We're so busy in our lives, and American culture is very individualistic. You know, we want our protective rights and we want to, you know, have that privacy, and that should be allowed. Privacy should be allowed, but also connecting with people. Like, we are so much more alike than we are different. What are our essential needs? We want to live, laugh, and love. We want to take care of our family. We want to be nourished. And so if we can focus on what those things are first, I think, you know, we can really change how we live. And I'll say this now and again, but suicide prevention isn't about death. It's not about preventing death. Suicide prevention is about promoting life and a life well-lived and worthy of living and wanting to be lived. And so what does that mean? That means saying hi to the stranger sometimes and smiling at someone walking down the street.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Alicia Hendry. She's the Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the County of San Luis Obispo. This is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And Alicia, let's talk about hope, resilience, and recovery, because that's the theme then for this year. How is that being impacted in the community when no one's leaving their home? How is it being utilized?
I know. So the idea of being resilient, I think, is something we should focus on here, and also something that we can learn from our youth. Youth are so resilient, and not to say that adults aren't, but the idea of adapting, being flexible, it's hard I experienced it myself. I had a routine. I was very resistant to changing that routine. But in order to, you know, really practice that resiliency, taking the hard time, the challenges, the adversity, and learning how, you don't have to necessarily find a silver lining, but learning how to adapt and make something new from that. September is also recovery month, and we know that there is a correlation between substance use and suicide and mental health conditions. And so we're really focusing on that intersection right now of finding a healthy balance, whether that be abstinence or whether that be harm reduction in your recovery, and how that can impact, how it positively impacts your mental health during this time. The idea of hope, I always hold on to hope. It's very difficult too. When every day you wake up to something new going on and your cousin's house burned down, and there's a lot going on, but knowing that there's more attention on suicide prevention and that more people are starting to want to be involved, I think gives us a lot of hope. People that have never maybe experienced a mental health condition before in their life are being challenged now mentally, physically, our stamina. The pandemic fatigue is a real thing I'm experiencing, and I think we all are. And so holding on to that hope that a better day will come because we're going to make it come. Like, we have to make that effort. And so focusing on that this month, and that recovery piece of supporting people through recovery, of, you know, really encouraging that resilience, that's what gives me hope. And that's what I hope others find as well.
So in the pandemic, how are you utilizing, you know, the, I don't know, the resources? Are there Zoom gatherings? You said you had a forum. You know, how can people engage in the activities and resources that are available right now?
Right. So I have been so incredibly impressed at my colleagues that provide those direct services with clients, and at other agencies too. They like went to telehealth almost immediately. So kudos. And to, of course, like all the educators, like everyone has gone to that. So I know some private therapy and also someone within the county are seeing people in person face to face. But we're still really focusing on that telehealth when it comes to like a therapy session or a drug and alcohol support group or something like that. And yeah, everything else is pretty much on Zoom. I, again, was a little reluctant at first, speaking to the reluctant therapist. I was just resistant to the change. And I think a lot of people have been, but then, you know, kind of taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture, we actually have more people attending our suicide prevention council meeting now that it's on Zoom, because they, you know, they're in different parts of the county and they can actually make it. So yeah, our council meetings are on Zoom. A lot of our other meetings are on Zoom. We, back in May, our department, along with Transitions Mental Health Association, we held a drive-through like care bag handout. And so we had 350 Cookie Company, a local place, donate us cookies individually wrapped. And so we handed out those with some care packages that had resource and stress balls and coloring sheets. So that's one way we adapted. And we all were in PPE. We had face masks and shields. So people are getting creative and we're adapting. We're trying our best to be resilient.
And I think the key in a lot of this is becoming a part of something greater than yourself.
Yes.
Detaching yourself to something that matters outside of your day to day. Even if you feel like you're crawling on your belly across the floor, if you have to take care of the cat or take the dog for a walk,
right,
or check on your neighbor who's elderly, that to find that, because I would imagine being part of the care packages and putting them together give you a sense of light and hope and lightness to be able to do one thing. But it doesn't have to be a grand gesture. It can be something as simple as dropping off a bag of lemons on your neighbor's doorstep. That is our mental health work as much as it's helpful for our neighbors.
Yeah, absolutely. Finding meaning in your work, definitely. And I live in San Luis Obispo. There's a community pantry around the corner for me that some neighbors built, and everyone's contributing, and those that need from it take from it, and those that can provide and donate to it do. And it's, I think, kind of what you were explaining just then, you know, how you can take care of yourself in not just the traditional ways, like, okay, there's exercise, I'm getting 8 hours of sleep, I still feel a particular way. So, you know, what else is out there to be involved in?
If people are needing to reach out for help right now, what are some of the resources that are available in our local counties?
So the SLO hotline is based out of San Luis Obispo, but you can call from anywhere. We have folks that call from Santa Barbara and Monterey County quite often. I also wanted to highlight something called the Friendship Line. And I think this is important to talk about because it's targeted towards folks who are 60 and over, and also with adults living with disabilities. So this could be folks who are, you know, kind of isolated in their house potentially, but it's a toll-free line and it's 24 hours and you can call it anytime. The number is 800-971-0016. And again, it's called the Friendship Line, and you can call it in crisis. You can call it if you're lonely, if you're feeling hopeless. Things are compiling right now. And so if you're just like, I don't know what to do, I don't have any family, I don't have any friends, you can just call and talk there. It's a warm line and a crisis line.
And give that number once again, and we'll have it available also at KCBX. That number is
1-800-971-0016.
And if you'd like to make a comment or get more information, you can call us at 805-549-8855, and we will be here to answer your call. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and my guest is Alicia Hendry, and we're talking about the unspeakable. We're talking about suicide and suicide prevention and awareness. This is Suicide and Prevention Awareness Month, the month of September. And we're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation about how the rates of suicide in San Luis Obispo County, considered the happiest place in America, are some of the highest in the country. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back in a moment to continue our conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and today we're talking about suicide and suicide prevention and awareness. And my guest is Alicia Hendry from the Suicide Prevention. She's a Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the County of San Luis Obispo. And I just want to say again, Alicia, I can't believe we've never met before, spoken before, because I think we could speak for hours on this topic. There is so much to cover.
I think you're right. Yeah.
So, Sarah, we had a call that you wanted to share.
We did. We had Jeremy called in to our 805-549-8855. He called to share that he has had to deal with a tremendous amount of guilt over the death of his brother 5 years ago. He had called his brother every day to check on him, but he had not been able to prevent the suicide. And he's realized that you might do everything you can, and it might not be enough. Therapy has helped him accept that the truth and that he's more okay now. That was from Jeremy.
Thank you, Jeremy. I appreciate you calling and sharing, because what we often don't pay attention to is that the loss of the person who takes their own life is one tragic part of the suicide story, but we often don't recognize the collateral damage to all of the family members and community that loved this person. And that's what Jeremy's experiencing. And Alicia, can you talk about the compounding effect of a suicide on a family?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for calling in, Jeremy, and saying that. I think that helps us with our conversations in general in the community. And I feel you. I've been there. And it's something that is discouraging for me sometimes when I'm out there doing trainings, and it's sometimes we could do everything in the world and it's not going to be enough. And so we end up, you know, we're left with, as a suicide loss survivor, we're left with so many unanswered questions and grief, and it's complicated. And, you know, research suggests that for every suicide death, there's 25 other attempts that we don't know about, and that for every death, on average, about 100 people are affected. And of course, the family and the friends and the people who are close to them, and also the, you know, the grocery store worker that they would see every Saturday, and the person at the coffee shop they would buy coffee from. And it's so normal to feel guilty, I think, because it's like, we love that person. How could we have not seen this? How could we have not saved them? And again, it's not, we could do everything in the world, and sometimes that person's pain is just so overwhelming.
And I think the grief you talked about also, it's complicated to grieve a suicide.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, grief in general, you know, we love and we miss the people that are no longer with us. But I think that there's just some inherent questions when people die by suicide, like, what could I have done differently? How could I have better supported them? What did I do wrong? And I can assure you that that person who dies by suicide is probably like, I'm being a burden to these people. You know, like they're thinking that they're hurting us by staying alive, because that's what happens when you're in crisis. You're in fight or flight mode and you're just trying to survive. So it's very complicated. And I hope that whoever is listening, if you've lost someone to suicide, know that it's not your fault. It's not your fault, and it's a common experience to feel that way. And I think that's a natural question to ask yourself after someone dies. But
I'm just glad that Jeremy reached out for counseling, because that actually working with death, grief, loss is well suited to talk therapy. That is a great place to work through those feelings, to have that safe space. So we have things like the Community Counseling Center and the different resources through Lifeline and the 1-800-273-TALK or the Friendship Line. Mm-hmm. Talking out grief is a great way for healing. It does move it forward. So Jeremy, I'm so glad you reached out for that, because I think that's where we get stuck. If we feel guilty or to blame or somehow we should have prevented it, it might prevent us from reaching out and getting help.
Right.
And I know in my own family, for my father, after my uncle committed suicide, he had that phone call the night before where my uncle was not doing great and my dad was busy, and it was, you know, that time, and that stuck with him forever. It's like, why didn't I stay on the phone longer? Why wasn't I more attentive? And so to carry that is a burden that can be eased. It never fully goes away, but it can be eased.
Yeah. And there's a support group that's ran by Hospice of Slo County, and it is on Zoom now, so they're doing it virtually, but it's specifically for those who have lost folks to suicide. So whether that is a family member, a close friend, someone that you cared about. So there is that support in the county as well.
So let's talk about talking about suicide.
Yes.
Maybe because, as I mentioned before, in my family, when my uncle took his life, it was not spoken. You didn't say it was suicide. So I'm looking at the statistics of children's rates of suicide and suicide attempts. And there has been a huge rise in children 10 to 14 who are taking their own lives.
Yeah.
10 to 14. And then 14 to 18 has always had high numbers. And yet, as you mentioned at the top of the show, we don't talk about it in school. We don't address it. We hide it, but the kids are somehow still feeling desperate enough to take their own lives. So what do we do?
Right. I mean, and just to talk more to that, anxiety, the median age of onset for anxiety is 11 years old. And so thinking that half the people with an anxiety disorder start to experience that before the age of 11, I mean, you like the statistics lead to that, right? Talking about suicide and death is extremely important. It's not something that, the hegemonic American culture necessarily does, but I think it's very necessary to do so. And you don't necessarily have to use the word suicide around an 8-year-old, but you could say, you know, like this happens when people experience very difficult times and they don't have the support and they don't know how to cope. Sometimes people take their own life because they don't see any other option. There are other options. And if you were to ever experience that, I hope that you would come to me to seek those options. There's age-appropriate ways, and the internet, if your child uses the internet, they could find information themselves on this topic. And so I think it's best that you can control that narrative, that you can be the one to start that and guide it and model that for the youth in your life, because it's better that they feel comfortable. Oh, I hear my parents talk about it. I can go to my parents for that, rather than search for these things online. Because as beneficial as the internet can be for support, it can at the same time be just as dangerous if you're not careful.
Well, and it's true when it comes to sex education and talking about suicide, two things that parents are desperately afraid of talking about with their children, because they're afraid that if we talk about sex, our children will become sexual. If we talk about suicide, they'll think of taking their own lives. But the opposite is true. Yeah. When we talk about them openly, when we talk about sex and make it available and beautiful and appropriate, then it gives our children a different narrative. And the same with suicide, because as you mentioned before, suicide isn't necessarily about death. It's about life. And how do we embrace our lives if we're feeling hopeless or suicidal? So our children need to know that they can come to us and say, I don't know what this feeling is, but I wish I were dead. Yeah. And then how do we help parents not overreact, not come undone if their children come to them and say, I wish I were dead? And how do we help parents to speak to that? What are those resources?
Right. So I'm just disclosing I am not a parent. And so I work with a lot of parents. And so I just want to disclose that as I talk about it. But getting involved on your school campuses, what are other parents up to? What conversations have they had? Lean on each other. Maybe this conversation has happened in a family unit and it went really well. What were those things that went well? What were the pros and cons of having that conversation? So again, when we're talking about suicide, open up that conversation with the parent group, and what's been going on. And I'm so happy to provide any sort of presentation about how to start those conversations. There's language to use when talking about suicide. So when we hear the term commit suicide, it sometimes can be really stigmatizing for some folks because there's people commit crimes, people commit murder, that type of thing. And we know that suicide often doesn't seem like, you know, it's not really a choice for people. It just happens because that's the only thing to do. So we really, you know, how to talk about suicide in a way that reduces the stigma, takes the guilt and the shame out of those conversations is really important. But also, you know, maybe you talk to your school counselors also for the parents, because a lot of them are involved day to day with youth that talk about wanting to die or not wanting to be here anymore. And so promoting also really healthy coping mechanisms as well is important.
Well, and I think from the clinician's point of view, I'm just going to flat out say,
please do.
Ask your children, do you ever feel like hurting yourself? Or any of your friends ever talk about hurting themselves? Or what do you think about suicide? Have you heard that term before? It's the same way we talk about sex with our children. We have to be bold enough to say, what do you know about sex? Where are you talking about that? And say the words out loud. So your children might not have anything to say in that moment, but once you've said those words out loud, have you ever felt like hurting yourself? Do any of your friends talk about that? Do you understand what suicide is? Now that that has been said out loud, if it comes up, you've broken the barriers. Because the mistake a lot of parents make is that they'll say, I'm very approachable. I tell my children all the time, they can ask me anything. But your children, if they don't know what to ask you, you're not helpful. And the other part is parents forget that your children don't want to freak you out, or they're concerned about how you'll respond. So you can think that you're the super open parent, but your child might be thinking, oh, I know I can't go to mom. So we have to get over our discomfort and just say the terms or the words out loud. Absolutely. And I know for my daughter, Kelly, my younger daughter, she had 7 fellow students commit suicide throughout her childhood from 12 to 22. From different aspects of her life. And after the third one, she was better able to talk to me about how this impacted her life than I was even capable of talking to her, because all I kept thinking was, how do you keep bouncing back? Yeah. But that goes to what you said before about resilience, and that if we have confidence in our children, they have the capacity to bounce back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. And you know, what style and form of communication is best for you and your family? Like, maybe, you know, if you have a hard time verbalizing it, maybe you have a community journal that's in your living room and there's topics that, you know, you write a theme on top and everyone writes about the topic in there. And then maybe a few weeks down the road, you can talk about it out loud. So, you know, you can get creative, and there's not a prescription or an exact script on how to have this. I so wish there was just like a magic pill you could take to make everything better. But yeah, it's getting creative. And And I know it can be hard. Like I don't have children, and I barely have time for myself sometimes between work and other obligations. And so I can see how that would be difficult to navigate and make time for it, but it's also imperative that we do so.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Alicia Hendry. We're talking about suicide prevention and awareness. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. And if you'd like any more information about our conversation today, resources that are available, you can give us a call at 805-549-8855, and we'll be happy to give you phone numbers and resources or take your comment or question. And so a couple things I want to follow with that, Alicia, is it's great to utilize television, movies, shows. That's another great way for parents to sit with kids and be able to talk about a topic that comes up that's portrayed on television. Just do a little Google search. You can type it in, shows that feature suicide, shows that feature, you know, hopelessness, and you can find them and watch them together. So it's another way to approach those issues. And also, again, the time alone your children spend on the screen. And I want to just really emphasize this, that there are sites everywhere that can be dangerous for children. And if you're not talking to them about suicide or eating disorders or sex, they can find online different groups that are talking about it. And there are probably groups out there that encourage suicide or talk about how you can, you know, attempt suicide. And so these platforms are not neutral. You know, our kids are spending a lot of time on screens with their screens with virtual school and, you know, communicating with friends, but we need to really be vigilant. But having said that, I want to bounce back to something that we started with. We are considered one of the happiest places in the world. Why are the rates so high in San Luis Obispo County?
Age-old question. I think one, there's a disillusionment about California in general and being happy here, right? That our cost of living is through the roof, and we don't have necessarily a booming economy compared to other locations. We don't have, you know, a lot of larger cities have psychiatric health facilities within their hospitals. They have learning hospitals where you have a lot, you kind of have a surplus of clinicians, you know, getting their degrees and working through their clinical hours. But we're very spread out in our county. We have one psychiatric health facility that has hosts 12 individuals. And if you have private insurance, you're not eligible to go there. We don't have a youth psychiatric facility. So if a youth needs to go to an inpatient situation, they're shipped out of county to do so. And then they'll come back and they're at school Monday morning all of a sudden, like, what just happened to me? I think that the Great Recession back in 2008 really affected a lot of people's retirement. Looking at the data and the age trend of suicide deaths, it points to kind of that retired age in our community. And it's also a generation that is like, pull up your bootstraps, you're fine, you have nothing to be sad about, get over it. And I'm not pointing blame on anyone. Like, that is a generational thing. Like, you were raised by parents that fought in World War II, and some people lived through the Great Depression, right? So cultures change. We're also a community of mixed cultures. And so, you know, different cultures have different meanings around suicide and mental health. And so a lot of reasons, honestly. And I my heart breaks for people who are in crisis that don't know where to go. And also people, you know, we have a lot of folks here living in our county with chronic illness, and chronic illness and pain is a risk factor for suicide. Managing that, for example, and our veteran population, where the VA hospital is 3 hours away, a lot of the times it's difficult to get that support. So while there's no single cause for suicide, you can start kind of looking at these community-based opportunities for intervention that we just don't have currently.
Like, in many ways, we're very rural for being the Central Coast. Yeah. We're very rural when it comes to services and support networks and facilities and resources.
Yeah. Well, we are in the same with the reimbursement rate for Medi-Cal. And so that's why we don't have as many providers that take that insurance, because, you know, the reimbursement rate is really low. Well, you also, you know, you have your own student debt and your family and your housing that you need to take care of. So sometimes people just take that to the larger cities. And I, you know, I nationally, we see demographic wise, the highest rate is in within our Indigenous population. And we also have like that older male white demographic. And that's not to say that people of other ethnicities and races and genders don't experience it. They do. I'm just specifically talking about the data that we have here locally.
Well, what in about that data, you know, for elderly white males, they tend to have the least access to social support. They tend to have the smallest circle of friends. If they end up divorced or widowed, they tend to not have a network of friends to lean on. So it becomes very isolating. And I think isolation is one of the big pieces. If we want to talk about how do we help or notice or recognize when people might be struggling, one of the keys is, are they isolated? How much connection do they have to other people? Do they have a routine or places that they need to show up? Are they starting to not reach out or answer phone calls? Are they starting to give away their property? Are they starting to talk about not needing to be here anymore or not wanting to be here anymore? One of the big red flags right now is what we're calling eco-anxiety or climate anxiety. People are talking about their fear or hopelessness in the future, that with, you know, looking at the fires and climate change and this sense of hopelessness can set in. Eco-anxiety is impacting a lot of people who might have never had mental health issues before, and we're seeing it today. So those of us who are looking around and paying attention to each other, if someone's talking a lot about the fires or feeling like they're trapped, trapped is huge. And you mentioned that earlier, when we feel like we have nowhere we can go, those can open up the doors to possible suicide attempts.
Yeah, because, you know, if we're talking about promoting life and promoting a life worth living, when you're watching the world literally burn around you, I could see how people would think that this is the end, that there's not going to be anything better or left for them when the fire is out. And that's, you know, that's the point where we adapt and we reach out to others, because I guarantee you are not alone in feeling that. It's incredibly scary thinking about what our future generations, what they're going to experience, right? But we're here now, and we're not alone in this fear. And we're not alone in, you know, our situations here, even though it might be unique to you, exactly what you're going through, your fear, your pain, other people are feeling that. And so just reaching out, and like you were saying, Elizabeth, like, hey, how are you doing? You know, I've been reaching out to my friends and I'm like, how are you holding up? Like, what the beep? You know what I'm saying? Like, it is like things are intense right now. And they've been intense in the past and they're going to be intense in the future. And so how we can form meaning together around that. And, you know, you could be 65 and retired and maybe, you know, divorced and what that looks like and isolated in the moment. And next year you could be taking French classes at Cuesta, you know, like there is hope, and it's going to be unique to your own experience and your own journey. But it starts with opening up your heart and your throat and talking to people.
And I always like to throw out a plug for Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, because I can't tell you how many people have read that book and it saved their lives. It's tough to read at the beginning, but it ends with so much great information and such great hope. So Man's Search for Meaning. And let's talk about resilience to close things up, because the skills for resilience, many people are born with them. They are resilient by nature. Right. But a lot of people don't realize that you have those skills inside of you. You have to tap in. Mm-hmm. And a couple of my favorites, and I'll let you throw out your favorites, but a couple of my favorites are resilience comes when we develop a sense of humor. So people who are able to find a laugh, even in the darkest of times, sometimes in the darkest of times, if you're able to laugh and to find humor or to watch something, you know, to lighten the mood, humor develops that resiliency, that bounce back, that ability to laugh at ourselves and laugh at the moment. And the other one is an experience of awe. And I think you mentioned that, but people who can still feel small and in awe of things like the birth of a bird, you know, where you see them come out of their shell, or when you walk into Yosemite for the first time, or when you see a baby, you know, those things, or a delicious meal that is amazing that you can't believe someone cooked. To be able to tap into those moments of awe are things that build resilience. They give us the capacity to be able to bounce back. And the thing to remember is that a lot of research shows that we never are as happy for as long as we think we're going to be. We work and work towards a goal, but you're never as happy as you think you're going to be. Mm-hmm. And conversely, you're never as sad or devastated for as long as you think you're going to be. That we fear sadness because we think it'll never end, but it does. Mm-hmm. So throw out a couple of your favorite resilience tricks.
Yeah, I'm just going to elaborate on that awe piece, because not only does it build resiliency, but experiencing that day to day or once a week also just improves quality of life. Yeah, so thank you for saying that and reinforcing that. I also think trying something new, and you might not be great at it, you might not enjoy it, so you can check it off and try something else afterwards. So I am all about trying new things, within reason, within my own means. But I think that also really goes to show that you're resilient, because a lot of the times people, you know, post high school or post college, depending, you know, what level of education, you're like, okay, the learning's done. No, we're always learning. And so what can we learn today? I think being open and honest with people about how you're doing is incredibly strong and brave and practice of resiliency. So actually telling people, like, I'm not okay today. I'm going to be okay, but I'm not today. And just like being honest, because then it might spark an amazing, beautiful conversation, and you might learn something new about yourself or those around you. Resiliency is also taking care of your physiological needs. So what are, you know, how are you nourishing your body? Are you drinking enough water? Those little things day to day that, like, I live in this world where, like, self-care is massages and spas, you know, I want it to be at least, but, like, no, it's self-care for me is honestly drinking enough water and making sure that I get some movement in every day and some nourishing food to replenish my body.
And intentionally doing those things, because I think when we make the intention, I'm doing this because it's good for me. Mm-hmm. I've talked a lot about on the show that when we hug someone, if you say to yourself before you hug them, I do this because I love you and this is good for me. Mm-hmm. And then you hug them, you get that double benefit of that. Yeah. A couple more resilience ideas is move towards goals. You know, life is always about moving forward. And mm-hmm. quite often we get stuck when we think, I'll just hang out until things start to get normal again. And that's a trap, because we never go back. We're always moving forward. So to look forward towards goals and to be a little belligerent in your style. Don't allow yourself to be walked over. So my guest today has been Alicia Hendry. She is the suicide prevention coordinator for the County of San Luis Obispo. Alicia, what is the phone number to contact the Behavioral Health Department for questions about classes or services that are offered?
Yeah, so we have our behavioral health access line. So if you have questions about therapy or how to access our psychiatric health facility, you would call 1-800-838-1381.
Fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
I appreciate your time. And again, if you want more information about what we spoke of today, give us a call at 805-549-8855. We have resources. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This has been a conversation for the Reluctant Therapist. You can reach out to me at my email, elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Share our show, podcast our show, and continue to take care of yourself. And thank you. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I'll give a little bit of my love.